the one who go over a gargantuan Rashi. Perhaps you went over it, but it's a big mafteach. It's a big key to the history and chronology. Remember, we mentioned last week, and Rashi mentions last week, that Yaakov and Esav at the time of the bracha, as the time of the bechira, when Esav sold his bechira to Yaakov, Yaakov and Esav were 15 years old. And the proof that Rashi gives us that they were 15 years old is based, it's not an ironclad proof, it's based on the supposition that Yaakov was cooking lentils because that's a food you give to a mourner, and that was the day that Abraham died. So the only way we connect it to Abraham's death is simply because of the lentils. Now, once you assume that Abraham died, it's very easy to calculate that Yaakov and Esav were 15 years old on that day, right? Because we know that Yaakov and Esav were born when Yitzchak was 60, and Yitzchak was born when Avraham was 100. So as a result, Yitzchak and Yaakov and Esav were born when Avraham was 160. Yeah, when Avraham died at 175, Yaakov and Esav were twins. They were 15 years old, right? So that's a fairly straightforward proof. But again, it's a proof that's based on a bit of a weak link, but the weak link is that the lentils were the food of Avelus, because that is when Abraham died, right? That's the first chashuvah. But then we have a later interpretation of Rashi. Again, it's based on the Midrash. And by the way, these Midrashic chronologies, which are very important, are actually, when I say Midrash, they're actually derived from a very specific Midrash. The Midrash is called Seder Olam. They should just be aware of the Seder Olam, which means the chronology of the world, is from the Tanoim. In fact, the author of Seder Olam is the Tana Rav Yossi. And this is what you might call the official rabbinic chronology, right? All of these statements, like the first Beis HaMikdash is 410 years, the second Beis HaMikdash is 420 years, and all of those different things, which are not explicit in the Tanakh, we get them from Seder Olam. And Seder Olam, in turn, is often quoted by the Gemara itself. Now, when the Gemara introduces it, the Gemara will just say Tanya. Tanya means a brisa. But you have to know, when you learn Tanya, I don't know, Chabad Tanya, but when you learn a Tanya in the, although that's good too, but when you learn a Tanya in the Gemara, remember, brisas usually have sources. Like, you know, people want to know, where can I find the brisa? Is there something called, a book called brisa? Well, there is no book called brisa. Like the only thing brisa means is, the word brisa means outside. In other words, it is a teaching of the Tanoim that is outside of the Mishnah, which is the highest source of Tanoim. But it, so brisa tells you what it's not. If something is a brisa, it's not a Mishnah. But it doesn't tell you what it is. So as a result, brisas can have many sources. A brisa could be a Tosefta, which literally means the appendix in the back of the Mishnah, again, written by Rav Chi and Rav Hoshea, sometimes. A brisa could be a Medrash Agoda. A brisa could be a passage from Seder Olam. A brisa could be, and it often is, this is the most common brisa, what we call the Halachic Midrashim. That's the Mechilta, which starts in Halachas. The Mechilta in Sefer Shmos, the Sifra on Vayikra, and the Sifri on Bamidbar and Devarim. There is no halachic medrash on Bereishis. Now, sometimes the Mesoras HaShas, which always tells you, you know, whenever something is quoted somewhere else, it tells you where it is. You know, there's a little asterisk, and you look at the side. That often doesn't tell you what Bereishis is. In other words, what it'll tell you with the Bereishis is, if this Bereishis is quoted somewhere else in the Gemara, it'll tell you if this Bereishis is quoted, you know, somewhere else in the Gemara. But that's not giving you the actual source. That's just telling you where else in the Gemara is the brisa quoted, which is, of course, very helpful, because you can look at Rashi or whatever it is somewhere else. He might explain something. So these chronologies are derived from Seder Olam, but this big chronology I'm going to go over with you is also at the end of the first parak of Megillah. So the first parak of Megillah quotes a long brisa, which happens to be from Seder Olam. And the brisa wants to show, the ultimate point of the brisa, which is going to get you through a lot of mazes, but the ultimate point of the brisa is that the mitzvah of Talmud Torah is so great that it overrides the great commandments of honoring your father and mother. And we're going to prove this by showing that Yaakov was punished for 22 years. Like Yaakov was separated from Yosef for 22 years because of the 22 years that he was separated from Yitzchak and didn't do Kibbutz Aviyim. But we're going to show through a very intricate calculation that actually Yaakov was separated from Yitzchak 36 years, another 14 years, but he was not punished for that because those were the 14 lost years that he was learning in the yeshiva of Shem V'Aver. So our ultimate point is going to be that although Yaakov gets punished for the years that he is not honoring his father, he is not punished for those years to the extent that he was Osek in Talmud Torah. Okay, that's going to be our end point. So how do we get to that end point? So we get to it the following way. Is there a chumash for this? I need a chumash for this. We have the story of the brachos. We have the story of the brachos. Now again, what's interesting about these chronologies is your very first point, which is the critical point that starts the whole process, is often a little bit of a weak proof, right? So for example, the proof that Yaakov and Esau were 15 starts off with the mere fact that you're assuming lentils equals Avraham's death. We start off with a similar kind of weak point, but it is the foundation of the building here, and that is, it says, after Yaakov took the brachos away from Esau. So Esau sees that the Canaanite women are not good in Yitzchak's eyes, so Esau goes to Yishmael. You know, you got to feel sorry for Esau. Even when he tries to do something right, he messes up. In other words, it's kind of piteous here because he knows, you know, he already took wives from the Chitim, the Ches, which he's not supposed to do. Okay. And now he sees how wrong that is. She says, okay, I'm going to do something right. I'm going to pick the right, you know, the right Shidduch. So he goes to Yishmael. You know, it's not like he didn't do much better. But it says, Esau went to Yishmael and he took Machlas Bas Yishmael Ben Avraham, and then it mentions Machlas is Achos Nevayos. Machlas is the sister of a guy called Nevayos. Nevayos is her brother, Yishmael's son. So we start off this way. Why is it important to mention Achos Nevayos? Who cares who her brother is? So Rashi says from Seder Olam, this teaches me that at the time that Esav married Yishmael's daughter, that's when Yishmael died. In other words, marriage negotiations began with Yishmael, but they were finalized by Nevayos. It's very similar, of course, to Yitzchak's own marriage to Rivka, right? Where the idea was Besuel began, and then Besuel was poisoned, and Lavan finished. Now, we do know from the Torah Yishmael was 137 when he died. So let's figure all of this out. If Yishmael was 137 when he died, and that was the time that Yaakov took the brachos from Esau, well, let's figure it out. If Yishmael was 137, how old was Yitzchak? Because now again, you have to remember, Yishmael was 13 years older than Yitzchak, right? We know that. We know that from the Torah, because Yitzchak was born when Yishmael was 13 years old. So if Yishmael was 137, so Yitzchak was 124. Now, if Yitzchak was 124, and Yaakov and Esav were born when Yitzchak was 60, so Yaakov and Esav were 64 years old, right? We can prove that indeed Yaakov, that even though Yaakov took the Bechora from Esav at the age of 15, but the story of the Brachos occurred when Yaakov and Esav were 64 years old. So Yaakov is still not married, etc., right? So Yaakov is not a young man at this point, right? 64 years old. Now, we know the following. We know, going further to Mechiras Yosef, that Yosef was thrown into the pit and sold into slavery when he was 17 years old. And we know that when Yaakov comes, Yosef is 39 years old. So that's the 22 years, 17 and 39. We know that Yaakov is 130 when he stands before Paro. Okay, so let's figure out how old Yaakov was when Yosef was born. Okay, again, Yaakov is 130 when Yosef is 39. So Yaakov is 91. Yaakov is 91 when Yosef was born. So Yaakov is 64 when he takes the brachos, and Yaakov is 91 when Yosef is born. Now, how many years did Yosef stay, recorded in the Torah, did he stay in Laban's house? So we know he worked 6 years for Leah. He worked 7 years for Leah. And then he worked another 7 years for Rachel. That's 14 years. Now, of course, you understand, by the way Chazal understand the narrative, it's not the pshat that, in other words, he worked 7 years and then he married, he thought he was getting Rachel, but he got Leah, a deception. But he didn't work 7 years and then marry Rachel. According to Chazal, he actually married Rachel only 1 week later, after Sheva Brachos. In other words, the concept was, he got Leah for cash and he got Rachel for credits. So the difference between the Rachel and Leah marriage was only 1 week. It was not 7 years. But Yaakov did have to work after he married Rachel. He had to work another 7 years. Of course, that's a tribute to his honesty, because Yaakov could have said, oh, I got Rachel, I'm just going to go. I mean, and then, for those 14 years, all of his wealth was for Laban. He basically worked. He just worked for subsistence. And then another 6 years, he stayed to make his own fortune. Okay, so he stayed in Laban's house for a total of 20 years. He then went back to Eretz Yisrael, and the trip took approximately almost 2 years. That's how you get to 22 years. There were 22 years he was poresh. Okay, there were 22 years that he separated from Yitzchak and did not fulfill the mitzvah of Kibbutz Aviyim. 7 years for Leah, 7 years for Rachel, and 2 years of traveling back. Now, let me just see another point over here. Yechav Shanim B'Beis Lavan, 7, 7, 6, and 2. Right, 7 Rachel, Leah, 7 Rachel, 6 for his own fortune, and 2 on the derech back. Okay, 1 second. Okay, Yosef was 30 this is something I'm missing here myself. In other words, the ultimate question is, what you have to have is the following. If Yaakov was 64 when he took the brachos, if you simply ignore, let's assume you just follow the Chumash. Remember, the Chumash does not record that he spent 14 years in yeshiva. Right? The Chumash seems to record that right after Yaakov left, he went to Laban's house. Now, here's going to be your problem. If we figured out that Yaakov is 64 years old, and then you would simply add the 22 years in Laban's house, that means when Yaakov came back, he would only be 86. And 64 and 22 would be 86. But okay, again, I'm missing a link here myself. 1 second, let me just see what the cheshbon is. All of Yaakov's sons, okay, all of Yaakov's children were born by the end of the second 14 years. had 7 years of Leah, 7 years of Rachel, but he was living with Rachel for those 7 years. Now Yosef is the last son that was born in Laban's house. We know that because we know Binyamin was born when Yaakov returns to Eretz Yisrael and Rachel dies in childbirth. So we know that Yosef was born as the last child in Laban's house. Yosef was born after Yaakov was in Laban's house for 14 years. So if you simply said the following, if you simply said that Yaakov was gone for 22 years, but Yosef was born after 14 years, right? So 64 and 14 would be 78. And Yosef was sold when he was 17. So the problem is this. The problem is that... One second. Chronologies are always hard to reconstruct. The problem basically is, okay, when Yosef stands before Paro, he's 30. So Yosef was a slave from 17 to 30. 9 years later, Yaakov comes. Because what's the 9 years later? 7 years of famine, of plenty, and then 2 years of famine, Yaakov shows up. Remember Rashi says that 5 years of famine were canceled. So, if Yosef was 30 when he stood before Paro and interpreted the dreams, and Yaakov comes when Yosef is 39, and the Torah says Yaakov is 130, this is critical, okay? When Yaakov is 130, Yosef is 39. But, if you ignore a stay Yeshiva Shem V'Ever, Yaakov would have been much, much younger. Because if you simply say that Yaakov left at 63 or 64 and had Yosef 20 years later, he would simply be 84 as opposed to being 91. So because of this, we have to posit that there were a certain number of years between Yaakov leaving Eretz Yisrael and Yaakov coming to Laban's house. And therefore he was older when Yosef was born, and that's how you get the matchup. So there is, in other words, we can prove from this cheshbon that there's a certain number of years, actually you can prove 14 years, that Yaakov was absent from Eretz Yisrael, but not in Laban's house yet. Those 14 years are the stay in the yeshiva of Shem V'Ever. Again, the question basically is that once we know how old Yaakov is at the time of the brachas, and that we prove from Yishmael's death, and we also know how old he was when Yosef was born, and we know that when Yosef was 39, Yaakov was 130, we know that, we have to prove that there's an extra number of years that would allow that to happen, right? These are the three things to keep in mind. Number one, how old were Yaakov and Esav at the time of the brachos? Number two, how old was Yosef and Yaakov at the time that Yaakov came to Mitzrayim? And based on that, you then have to figure out how old was Yaakov when Yosef was born. But then, you only get that calculation correctly if you posit 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem V'Ever. So Rashi says in the Gemara Megillah that those 14 years in Shem V'Ever, Yaakov was not punished for not fulfilling Kibbutz Aviyim, because Talmud Torah is greater than Kibbutz Aviyim. Now, what is this yeshiva of Shem V'Ever anyway? Shem, of course, is Noach's son, and Aver is Shem's grandson. And in point of fact, Shem and Aver are actually great-great-grandparents of Avram and the like. Whether Shem is still alive, it's not entirely clear. Shem is probably dead, but Aver is still alive. What type of yeshiva was this? They learned Gemara. What did they learn in the yeshiva of Shem V'Aver? And who were the disciples of this yeshiva, other than Yaakov Avinu itself? So it seems fairly clear. The yeshiva of Shem V'Eber was not a yeshiva in the way we would call it today. They weren't learning Gemara, per se. It was primarily a yeshiva about godliness, about ruchnias, about kedusha. You might call it a Kabbalah institute, a real Kabbalah institute, in which people would contemplate and meditate on the notion of God. Now, the question would be, interestingly enough, did Avraham go to the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber? Avraham didn't live in that yeshiva, that's for sure. Did Yitzchak go? And even Yaakov apparently didn't go until he was 63 or 64, because he learned everything from Avraham and Yitzchak. Who went? Obviously, the people who went were fundamentally Goyim. These were Noahites. These were B'nai Noah, who were contemplating the worship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But it is said that the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber in particular is the yeshiva that prepared a person to live in a hostile, non-spiritual environment. Because after all, Shem was the person who remembered a world that was so totally corrupt that the whole world was destroyed. So it's interesting that Yaakov didn't need a yeshiva of Shem V'Eber as long as he was living in Eretz Yisrael and as long as he was living in the environment of Kedusha, of Avram and Yitzchak. But when Yaakov is about to go to Laban's house, which is an environment that's totally hostile, totally without Kedusha, he needs the chizuk of the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber, right? That's an important idea. That Shem V'Eber is the yeshiva of Golos. It's not the yeshiva of Eretz Yisrael. Now, where was it located? Again, we don't really know. I mean, the problem is, the one mention of Shem after the flood, he's not called Shem. But if you remember, after Avram defeats the four major kings, and Avram liberates his nephew Lot, so it mentions Malchi Tzedek. Malchi Tzedek, the king of Shalem, brought out Lechem and Yayin. And this Malchi Tzedek is called a Kohen L'Kael Elyon, a priest to the High God. So what does Rashi say? Malchi Tzedek is actually Shem, the son of Noah, who in Avram's time was still alive. And he was called Malchi Tzedek, king of righteousness, because even in the ancient world before the Jews conquered Eretz Israel, the king of Shalem, which is Yerushalayim, was known. It was a hereditary title, like Paro is the king of Egypt. Malchi Tzedek, the king of righteousness, was the name of the Yerushalayim. So apparently, in Avram's time, we find Malchi Tzedek in Yerushalayim. So it's a strange thing. Yaakov goes to the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber when he runs away from his father, but the only thing we know about Shem is he was living in Yerushalayim. Right, so, was the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber in Yerushalayim? I don't know. It could very well be, according to this interpretation, for those 14 years, Yaakov was actually in Eretz Yisrael, because that is where the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber was. And even though, hashkafically, this was a yeshiva that prepared you for Golos, but it may have been physically located in Eretz Yisrael. Unless you're going to say that the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber is not necessarily the same place where Malchi Tzedek lived. Malchi Tzedek may have lived in Yerushalayim. The yeshiva was somewhere else. We don't really know about where the yeshiva of Shem V'Eber is. I think I mentioned the other day that Malchi Tzedek was the king of Shalem. Shalem was the original name of Yerushalayim. Before it was called Yerushalayim, it was called Shalem. And that's where you get the English Salem. Salem is Shalem. You know, in a lot of English translations, they take out the H. Like just like Jerusalem, right? Salem, Salem. Now, where do you get the Yeru? So the Yeru is, Yerushalayim had two parts. There was the city called Shalem, and then there was the Temple Mount that was originally called Har HaMoria, not Moriah, but what did Avram call it? Avram renamed it. Avram called it Hashem Yireh, Yireh. God will see, he will look down at this mountain and see the Akedas Yitzchak as a perpetual zechus for Am Yisrael. So it turns out, from that day forward, from the Akedah forward, just like Lahavdil Minneapolis and St. Paul, Lahavdil, Yerushalayim had two names, Shalem and Hashem Yireh, or in short, Yireh. So Yerushalayim is actually Yireh Shalem. The Har HaBayis was called Yireh, and the rest of the city was called Shalem. And the Mefarshim say, since Yireh is Yud Resh Aleph Hey can be contracted to above. You can make Yireh Yeru. So the name of the two parts of the city is Yerushalayim. Now that's still not exactly, that's closer to the English. Jerusalem. Yerushalayim. Not Layim, not a Yud, Yerushalayim. And in fact, if you look in Tanakh, first of all, in the Chumash, except for the reference to Shalem, Yerushalayim is never mentioned at all. In fact, does anyone remember when the Torah refers to bringing sacrifices in the place of the Beis HaMikdash? The Torah never says Yerushalayim at all. It does not mention the name. What does the Torah refer to? It always tells you, tantalizingly, you shall bring your korbanos b'makom asher yivchar Hashem, the place that God will choose for you. It was actually kept a secret, although the tzaddikim knew because of the Akedah. As the Rambam says in the Mor Nevuchim, Hashem does not tell us in the Torah that his Beis HaMikdash is going to be in Yerushalayim, because if he told us that ahead of time, he says the tribes would have fought. See, as it were, the Har HaBayis, if you know from the Gemara Megillah, was actually allocated to two tribes. The Beis HaMikdash is actually split. Part of it is in the portion of Shevet Yehuda, and part of it is in the portion of Shevet Binyamin. It's along a border. Just like, you know, somebody told me, I read that there was there's a public library in Vermont, on the Vermont-Canadian border. And the border runs through the public library. And I don't know why they built it there. And literally, if you take out a book from a shelf and you have to check out a book, you have to go through a border control. I mean, it's relatively fast, but there is somebody in the library, and you have to check your passport and everything else. So, all right, Baruch Hashem, you don't have to do that in the Beis HaMikdash, but the Beis HaMikdash does have its splits. But the Rambam says, fascinatingly, if the tribes knew ahead of time that the Beis HaMikdash is going to be built in that portion, in that Yerushalayim, they would have quarreled. They never would have agreed to the tribal division. They wouldn't have agreed that Yehuda or Binyamin should get Yerushalayim. They would have fought. So Hashem concealed it, so nobody knew where the Beis HaMikdash would be till after the land was already conquered. This is what the Rambam says. So, but nevertheless, the Makom HaShe Yivchar is the two districts called Yireh and Shalem. Yireh, Shalem. So how do you get Layim? How do you get that extra Yud? So the Medrash says, very, very beautifully, the extra Yud is actually a plural. Yerushalayim, just like Yad is one hand, Yadayim is two hands. Regel is a foot, Raglayim is 2 feet. Ozen is an ear, Osnayim is 2 ears. Yerushalayim is one city. Yerushalayim are 2 Jerusalems. 2 Jerusalems. Not East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. That doesn't count. We're only one city, of course. But the heavenly Yerushalayim Shalmala, Yerushalayim Shalmata, and the heavenly Yerushalayim is opposite the earthly Yerushalayim, the gateway to Shalayim. That's why it's called Yerushalayim. But that is why in Tanakh, although Yerushalayim is pronounced Yerushalayim, it is always written without a yud. Not in the Torah. The Torah doesn't mention Yerushalayim, but in the books of the Nevi'im, where we mention Yerushalayim, look, you'll check, it is always without a yud, Yerushalayim. Although we read it, the Kri is Yerushalayim, but the Ksiv is always Yerushalayim. Be it as it may, Malchi Tzedek was the king, and it seems logical that the yeshiva of Shem V'Aver was located there, which is an interesting point. Maybe the lesson here is that even when you need to be prepared for Golus, you need to prepare in Eretz Yisrael. You need to kind of get your strength here so you can then combat Golus, right? That's why, that's right. Although hopefully you'll stay here too, but even if you have to go back to Golus, at least you absorbed and internalized the holiness of Eretz Yisrael. But this din that Rashi proves, go back to the first thing we started, this thing that Rashi proves that Yaakov is Nanash for the 22 years. He was not with Yitzchak, but he's not Nanash for the 14 years of the Yeshiva of Shem V'Aver. We learn out that Torah learning is greater than Kibbut Aviyim. This is actually a rule that's very, very practical, although maybe impractical in its implementation. And that is, technically, if your parents want you to leave yeshiva, they demand you leave yeshiva. Technically, if you're still learning Torah, the mitzvah of Talmud Torah overrides the mitzvah of Kibbut Aviyim. In fact, there are three areas in halacha where we say that the mitzvah overrides Kibbut Aviyim. Well, first of all, for any mitzvah, obviously, if your parents tell you to transgress Shabbos, you don't listen to them. But the poskim mentions specifically that there is no Kibbut Aviyim against Talmud Torah. Number two, there is no Kibbut Aviyim in the choice of a shidduch. Now, that doesn't mean you don't seek your parents' blessing and you don't consider it important, but it does mean that if indeed you are totally convinced this is the right person, you do not break a shidduch or get engaged because your parents tell you to do it that way. You have to make your own decision. And the third is Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael, that even if your parents don't want you to live in Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah of Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael overrides. Now, not only is Talmud Torah more important than Kibbut Aviyim, but even if theoretically you know your parents are from it, they want you to learn in another yeshiva, and you feel this yeshiva is better for you, whatever it is, even in terms of a choice of yeshiva, you make your decision. No, we're not talking about a 5-year-old who says he likes this guy better than that guy. You know, but if once you're an adult and you're able to form these judgments with maturity, you have the right, according to halacha, to make the decision. Now, again, I do want to emphasize on all of these things. Just because there's no mitzvah of Kibbut Aviyim, that doesn't mean you don't take your parents' input into account. That your parents might, depending on the issue, they might have more experience, they might have more wisdom, etc. It just means they can't pull out a trump card, you got to listen to me because of Kibbut Aviyim. But maybe they're making sense, right? What did Mark Twain say? Mark Twain said that when he was 17, he thought his parents were very foolish. And when he was 22, he was just surprised how smarter they got in 5 years. He said, amazed, how did they get so smart in 5 years? You know, and, you know, we encounter that, you know, as younger people, you know, we sometimes think we know better. Well, we have to keep it up. Yeah, you got to be respectful, but they don't really understand things. Life experience means a lot. The Gemara in Kedushin says you have to honor older people, even if they're Amaratzim, because they went through life, and life teaches a person a lot of things. And one has to be respectful of that. So this is an important idea. Saying that there's no mitzvah of Kibbut Aviyim for Shiduchim, for Yeshiva, and for Aliyah, doesn't mean you ignore the possible wisdom of what your parents are saying, but ultimately, there is no mitzvah of Kibbut Aviyim in those areas. You still have to be respectful, but there's no mitzvah of listening to your parents in those areas per se. But the interesting thing is, you may have no mitzvah to listen to your parents, but your parents do not have to financially support a decision they consider wrong. So let's say, to make it simple, let's just say you have a frum family, right? Father thinks you would be better off in another yeshiva. And you're convinced, talking to your rebbeim, that this is the best yeshiva. So are you mechuyev to listen to your father? No, you're not. Is your father mechuyev to pay for a yeshiva when he thinks you'd be better off somewhere else? Also not. So in effect, dad does have the pressure of the purse strings if it comes to that. And halacha considers that legitimate. Halacha considers it, it's not blackmail, halacha considers it legitimate that if I feel, as a parent, a decision is better for you, I can use finances as a way of urging you to make a better decision. Right? So that's going to be the dilemma. And that's why you try to work these things out by compromise and by shalom, as opposed to kind of saying, I'll do what I want because that's the halacha and the like. But that is the inyan that Talmud Torah is such an important thing, that it even overrides the mitzvah of kibbutz, kibbutz of inyan.
Two questions about kibbutz of inyan.
Yep.
So they can't, you don't have to listen to their input on a shidduch.
Yes.
But do you have to listen to their input on, for example, whether or not to use birth control after you've already had 6 kids, boys and girls?
Okay, so in truth, this is a much deeper question, more complicated question than I presented. I presented 3 discrete areas we're supposed to talk about: Eretz Yisrael, Talmud Torah, and Shidduch. In truth, these 3 areas exemplify a much more general idea, and that is that once a child is an adult, so to speak, Kibbutz of Yom does not mean you have to listen to your parents on anything at all, really. In other words, you don't have to listen to your parents about what job you take, where you live, and how many children you have. The basic idea is Kibbutz of Yom primarily refers to the notion of honoring your parents by helping them in any way that you can, by giving them food and drink, by walking them if they need, by taking them to a doctor. It involves respect by standing up when they come into a room, although we're often mochel on that. But there is no general. People misinterpret kibbutz of yom actually does not mean I have to listen to what my parents tell me to do. It's interesting. It actually doesn't mean that. An adult is empowered to make all decisions of his life on his own, without having to listen to his parents, although, once again, you always listen to them in terms of their wisdom, but they don't have a veto. So mom and dad cannot tell you, halachically, I don't want you to have, I mean, they can tell you, but you don't have to listen, I don't want you to have any more kids or anything else. As long as you show them respect, as long as you show them honor, there is no halacha, you have to listen. You make your own decisions in life. So these 3 are really exemplary of that basic idea. Okay, so parents do not have the right to tell. Now again, can they express an opinion? Well, they can. I mean, whether that's particularly within their scope is a question, but they can express an opinion. Do you listen? Well, birth control, of course, is a big halachic shaila. I mean, you can't just make a decision, I don't want to have more kids, you know, but you know, whatever, they can express an opinion. You go to a rav, you go to a posek, you weigh the difficulties that you're facing, and then you make a decision. But there is absolutely no kibbutz of yom there on a decision about how many children you're supposed to have. Once again, if they are giving you financial support, that may be a factor that may make their words more convincing. But on the other hand, without getting into this whole thing, I mean, lack of finances is usually not the halachic basis for a heter of birth control per se. You have to have something more than just lack of money.
So it sounds like any halacha over at Kibbutz of Yom, it's more like preferences. Like, oh, I want to dominate this shul instead of that shul, but daddy goes to that shul, so he wants you to go to that shul with him. So you're still going to get a kosher minyan. It's just not the one that you want.
Even then, there's at least a question. It's not so much that even then there's Kibbutz of Yom, but I would say that at least if it's not conflicting with something that is of fundamental importance to you, like what yeshiva you go to, I think usually you should try to defer to your parents. That's a way of honoring them. But when it comes to even a decision like what job, you know, you might say, well, whether I work here or work here, that's not a matter of halacha. But if it's a major decision that really impacts on you, you are not mechuyav. In other words, keep in mind, the Torah envisions the idea that adults make decisions in life. I mean, the Torah does not envision that mommy and daddy are going to make all your decisions for you. Again, we always listen to their wisdom. That's very important. Their wisdom matters, and it's important to listen to. But the notion that Kibbutz of Yom is somehow a veto, you know, they tell you who you marry, they tell you where you work, they tell you how many kids they have, they tell you where you live, that's not true. So it's important to recognize that Kibbutz of Yom is a mitzvah that starts from the day you're born till as long as your parents are alive, and even after your parents died, it's mitzvah keep it up yay. But it takes different forms when you're a child and when you're an adult. You know, when you're a child, yeah, dad says to do something, you got to do it. When you're an adult, it takes a different tsura. You honor and revere, but the Torah envisions that you make your own decisions in life. And, I mean, that's true not just for your biological parents, but that's true for your spiritual parents. I mean, a person has a Rebbe, a person develops Kesharim, but the concept is not that a Rebbe makes every decision for you in your life. A Rebbe is supposed to give you, or a yeshiva is supposed to give you a derech, a hashkafa, an approach, a set of tools that you can try to see how the Torah wants you to live. But you then have to make your own decisions, meaning, again, I don't mean to say you don't ask advice, but the concept basically is, you know, a yeshiva fails if it does not enable a person to independently come to it. Meaning, if you have to ask every single time you have a problem in life, every single time, and you don't have the tools to at least think out what the different possibilities are, then I have to say the yeshiva fails, because the goal of yeshiva is not to create a culture of perpetual dependency. It's to give people the tools, right? Even in learning, right? What's our goal? Our goal is not that, you know, you'll need Jastrow, you'll need Art Scroll, you'll need a teacher to tell you what every line of Gemara is. Right? What's the goal? That you should be able to take a Gemara and, you know, look at it and learn it yourself, right? So that's true in learning. And that's true in Hashkafa, that's true in life as well. That you should have a Torah approach that you can then apply in your life. So Kibbut Aviim is a lot of the same things. You absorb values from your parents, you absorb good things from your parents, you absorb their wisdom, but you then have to become your own person too.
Yeah. Well, what does it mean that a yeshiva should give you a hashkafa? Because I always imagine it's something you should sort of develop yourself. Your own experience.
Well, yeah, I don't mean necessarily a definite hashkafa, although it depends, but it should give you the tools by which you can formulate a Torah approach to life. And different people have different approaches. A good yeshiva does not necessarily inculcate one single direction for everybody. For example, everybody should learn all day, nothing else. That wouldn't be correct. For some people that's the right thing, some people it's not the right thing, right? But a yeshiva should expose you, should give you enough Torah, Yiras Shamayim, and enough guidance that you eventually can then internalize these different values and determine, you know, what's best for me. Again, in consultation, I'm not suggesting you don't consult, you don't talk, you don't ask advice, but all I'm saying is one shouldn't be overly dependent on this. One should have the capacity to make your own decision. That was what we call the Litvish tradition. And in fact, what's happened today is we've become a little more Hasidish. Just like a Chassid is very dependent on a Rebbe, we become very, very dependent. But people have said it's not that's not the best thing all the time. People need to stand on their own two feet and take a certain amount of responsibility for the decisions that they make in life. Okay? All right, well, we'll stop here. Have a good
Thanks so much. Yeah.